Well, for some time I've wanted to start a talk off just like I'm going to do right now, and I haven't had the opportunity. How many of you know this guy, John Nash, or know of John Nash? So he won a Nobel Prize in economics, and I guess recently, or some few years ago. And what's interesting about him is that he was clinically insane for many years before his Nobel Prize. I gave a talk on a subject almost the same as the one I'm going to talk about now at Princeton a few months ago, and I wanted to open that talk like this again, but I lost the nerve to do it, and John Nash was in the audience. So if you take this book, A Beautiful Mind, and you turn to page 220, you'll find some words like the following. Nash left the Institute for Advanced Study on a fractious note. A fractious note, I don't know that word. In early July, he apparently had a serious argument with Oppenheimer about quantum theory. And it goes on a little bit and it says, Nash's letter to Oppenheimer shows that before leaving New York, Nash had begun to think seriously of attempting to address Einstein's famous critique of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Goes on a little further, it says. He apparently had devoted what little time he spent at the Institute for Advanced Study that year talking with physicists and mathematicians about quantum theory. And it finally ends with this paragraph. It was this attempt that Nash would blame decades later in a lecture to psychiatrists for triggering his mental illness, calling his attempt to resolve the contradictions in quantum theory on which he embarked in the summer of 1957, quote, possibly overreaching and psychologically destabilizing. Well, I think that provides the perfect contrast between quantum foundations in 1957 and quantum foundations in 2008. I don't think that it's any longer a subject that is psychologically destabilizing. I think there's a whole lot of work, fruitful work, that can be done. And maybe a better metaphor for quantum foundations now is something like NASA tried to sell to support the space program in the 60s. So there were these airy-fairy engineers who wanted to go to the moon, and NASA, of course, was happy with that. But when they turned to the public, they said, there's so many spin-offs that you can use. For instance, you can have orange drink, like Tang. So I think that this is, if quantum foundations really has some effect on physics, it's not just completely internal to quantum foundations, but I think particularly in quantum information recently, we have found that things that started off as quantum foundations have turned into the basic ideas of quantum information theory. And I think there's some hope that ultimately quantum foundations can contribute to quantum gravity and to string theory. And this talk will be hopefully of that flavor. What I want to talk about in great detail is just a particular geometric problem that has arisen, and a lot of people around here, in-house people, Robin Blum-Kahout, Steve Flamia, and myself have devoted a lot of time to it. Some recent visitors, Marcus Appleby, Lane Houston, Jan-Åke Larsson, and a lot of previous visitors. I tried to tabulate the ones that I knew of that had devoted a considerable amount of brain pulp to this problem. So this is a problem that's been live and active within this building, and I want to give you an introduction to it and tell you some of the basic things that are known, the very basic things that are known about it, and also give you a little bit of a motivation for it that comes from quantum foundations, so that you get a sense that at least at some level it's quantum foundations. And then if you're not doing foundations yourself, as many of you aren't, you can just forget about that aspect and say, here's something about quantum mechanics that perhaps I should keep in my head. What I'm really interested in is understanding the structure of quantum states. And by understanding the structure, what I'd like to build is a geometric picture of quantum states based on a certain point of view about quantum states. What I mean by quantum states are density operators, or another way to say what a density operator is it's the convex hull. It's the set of all convex combinations of one-dimensional projectors. These are operators that live in the linear vector space of some operators on, and in this case, always a finite dimensional Hilbert space of dimension D. And they have these properties that they're Hermitian, they're trace one, and their eigenvalues are all greater than or equal to zero. So I say I want to understand these things from the point of view, from the interpretational point of view, that they don't represent actual properties of quantum systems. So when I have a quantum system and I write down a quantum state for it, I'm not saying that system has this state intrinsic to itself, but rather the point of view that this in some way represents knowledge rather than a property of the system by itself. The sorts of questions that one can ask in from this point of view are, for instance, well, if there are states of knowledge, why should those states of knowledge be captured or codified by this structure? That's the sort of question that one might ask. Another sort of question that one can ask is, suppose you are given a quantum state and you're given some observable, that means some Hermitian operator, and you want to calculate the probabilities of the outcomes of measuring making a measurement corresponding to that operator, then we know that we calculate the probabilities according to the Born rule. We take the eigenprojectors and we take the density operator, take the product, take the trace, and that represents the probabilities of the outcomes. We can ask, well, why this rule and not some other? Where does the Born rule come from? John Smolin did that vocally at some conference 2 years ago when he said, the discussion at this foundation's meeting is boring. Can you test this idea? Well, the idea that quantum states are knowledge bifurcates in two directions. One common direction, one common path to take is to think that density operators are generalizations of classical probabilities, and that there's this larger structure called quantum probability theory, and within that larger structure, there's a little piece of it that one might call classical probability theory. Classical probability is just the commutative case of this larger structure. That's a direction that collaborators and I don't follow, and by collaborators, I mean this set of people, Marcus Appleby, Carlton Caves, Matt Liefer, Rudiger Schock. Luckily, Matt's not here because he might protest that I put him in the list. If you want to know more about this point of view, just look up any of our papers on the QuantPH archive. And there's a very nice article by Chris Timpson. He doesn't support us exactly, I would say, but he summarizes the whole point of view. These guys reject this idea that probability theory is just a subset of this larger thing, quantum probability theory. And the basic reason is that we think that's a category error. That if you buy that, then essentially you're saying either that mathematical logic itself is just a branch of physics, or you're saying that physics is a branch of mathematical logic. We think they're apples and oranges. For instance, if you bought the idea that mathematical logic was a branch of physics, what are you to make of something like the method of least squares fitting that you use for confirming your theory in the first place? If that's a branch of physics, then you're using a method that's implied by a branch of physics when you think you're testing another branch of physics. It leads to a big muddle. So instead, we take this other point of view, that there's this basic layer of thinking called probability theory. Probability theory has nothing a priori to do with physics. Probability theory has to do with rules that one should use in making gambles. If you believe this about something and you believe that about something else, how should you gamble about a third thing? That's what probability theory is about. And on top of probability theory, then one can add a layer that specifies what the subject matter is. So for instance, probability theory could be applied to economics. And what that means is you say, I've got this general structure called probability theory, and I'm now going to use it to make some estimates to understand exactly how I should bank, for instance, or what sorts of currencies I should buy. The subject matter is economics. It's not probability theory itself. It's a layer that one adds on top of probability theory. Well, similarly with physics, and in particular quantum mechanics, there's probability theory. And then to that, one adds a layer that has something to do with the properties of the physical world. The properties of the physical world mold how you'll tie your various probabilities together. So that's the point of view we take. What is the subject matter that we're adding on top of probability theory when we're doing quantum mechanics? I was thinking last night of how I might best express what I think is the greatest lesson of quantum theory, or our foundational struggles in quantum theory, and this came out of me. I think the greatest lesson is that every physical experiment is a transaction with nature, that these things called quantum measurements are interactions between some gambling agent and a piece of the world that has nothing to do with the agent a priori. And what you're gambling on is about the result of these things. So from this point of view, and the end of this long introduction, when one goes from classical uses of probability theory to quantum instances of probability theory, one is not changing the idea of probability, but rather one is focusing on one particular usage of probability theory rather than another. It's not that our probabilities are about some states that are pre-existent, states of pre-existent reality, but rather the consequences of measurement interactions. So every application of probability theory in quantum mechanics is about predicting consequences of measurements, which leads me to draw this picture, that this is what's going on. A quantum state in some way or other represents knowledge. Knowledge about what? Knowledge about what will come about if one interacts with a quantum system via some measurement device, pictured here on the hands of this guy. So that's the big picture. That's what I'd like to develop.
Independently of people. If there are no people, there's no quantum mechanics. And the evolution of the universe is computed in quantum mechanics is not valid because there were no people around to do
it. That may be one aspect of it. I would say that more basic is the idea that without someone to gamble, there is no such thing as probability. So it's at a level before physics, that probabilities represent degrees of uncertainty. And indeed, I want to put quantum mechanics in that mold. Now, there's a difference, and this question always comes up, there's a difference between that idea, that probabilities don't exist without a gambling agent, and the idea that this thing out here, this block of stuff, doesn't exist. And I don't go so far as to say that. So what I want to do is write quantum mechanics in a way that makes that idea just as clear and as concise and as consistent as it can possibly be made. And maybe ultimately it's not consistent, but by the effort of trying to write quantum mechanics in those terms, we'll find that out. So here's the goal here, and this will lead to the geometric problem that I'll tell you about in the next 45 minutes. I'd like to find a clean representation of quantum states purely in terms of probability distributions. And in particular, I'd like to pose all of quantum mechanics, not in terms of these more basic, seemingly more basic structures, quantum states, but purely in terms of probability distributions. How can you do it? Well, the idea goes like this. One imagines that not only do we have standards of length and weight, but there are also standards for with respect to which we compare our degrees of belief. So in the Bureau of Standards, I'm not only going to have the standard kilogram and the standard ruler, but also something I'll call the standard quantum measurement. And when I have a quantum system out here for which I ascribe some quantum state rho, what I am really doing is in some encoded way representing my degrees of belief about what will happen or what would happen if I were to take this quantum system up to this measurement device and drop it in and wait for a click. This thing represents, the hope here is that I can find a way of representing this thing in terms of degrees of belief that one or another click will go off in this measurement device if I were to take this system up there. So in place of density operators, we end up with probabilities. Now, if I'm talking about some other measurement device that I might use on my quantum system, one out here, it's different. Notice this has four dots. This one has three. It's a different thing. The purple measurement device out here, then I will have some degrees of belief about which click will occur here. And what I'd like to do is set up the formalism in such a way that I can take these degrees of belief and uniquely calculate these degrees of belief. Now, alternatively, if I were to consider a third measurement device, something else, this one's the orange measurement device, again, I should be able to calculate probabilities for the outcomes of this measurement in terms of the probabilities for the outcomes of that measurement, and so on. And just because I did three layers of it, I'll put all three. All three. I mean, you know, you can't go to that much work and not show it. So what are these things called measurements? What is it that I'm wanting to put up here? Now, what kind of audience do I have? Do I have, how many super string people are out here? Three of you. And how many quantum gravity people? And everybody else is quantum information, is that right? Ah, I wanted to skip the next 25 slides. Okay, so what is it that I might be able to put up here in a Bureau of Standards that will allow me to do this trick of writing quantum mechanics purely in terms of probabilities? Well, we're accustomed to saying that what we mean by a measurement or an observable in quantum mechanics is a Hermitian operator. And we know what we do with Hermitian operators. We diagonalize them. We write it in terms of the eigenvalues and eigenprojectors. And as I've already told you, the Born rule says you take the quantum state that you have, you calculate the probabilities according to this nice formula. Because it's going to be useful for my notation in a minute, I just want to point out that these probabilities, the things we're concerned with, don't depend upon the eigenvalues that appear in this operator. They only depend upon the eigenprojectors. So it's equivalent, at least as far as this set of problems are concerned, to think of a measurement as a set of operators, as a set of eigenprojectors. So I want to ask this question. Will one of these measurements do for the task that I'm setting before myself, which is to give a unique specification of the quantum state in terms of probabilities? And the answer is it will not do. And you can see that trivially. If you take some observable H, you find its eigenprojectors, and calculate the probabilities give you the diagonals, the diagonal elements of the density operator in that basis. But they tell you nothing whatsoever about the off-diagonal terms. So information is lost by considering this set. If you only consider this set, you recover from that the diagonal elements of a density operator, but you don't recover anything about the off-diagonal elements. But those of us in quantum information know that that's not all we can do and call a measurement. There are other things that can be done in the laboratory that we would be willing to call a measurement. These are called generalized measurements, or sometimes positive operator valued measures. And the structure of that kind of measurement is quite analogous to what we just saw before. All we're going to do is relax one requirement on what we call a measurement. So previously, I had called a measurement a set of operators that are eigenprojectors. So that means they're positive semi-definite operators. If I sandwich a quantum state around these guys, this is always greater than or equal to zero. They're orthogonal. They give me a resolution of the identity. So if I sum them up, I get the identity operator. I calculate my probabilities according to the Born rule. And this is just kind of redundant with what I've already said, but I assume that these are projection operators that are all orthogonal to each other. The notion of measurement more commonly used in quantum information theory, on the other hand, drops this last requirement. So again, one thinks of a measurement as a set of operators. The set of operators denote the possible outcomes of the measurement. For each outcome in a measurement, there's an operator. There's an operator, there's an operator, there's an operator. They're all positive semi-definite. They add up to the identity. You calculate the probabilities according to the Born rule again. But you drop this requirement that they be projection operators. So there's no requirement that the E sub B be projection operators. And there's no requirement that they be orthogonal to each other. Now, if you're not in quantum information, this idea seems mysterious, but it turns out to be a simple consequence of the usual, or one can view it as a simple consequence of the usual notion of measurement. Take a system and allow it to possibly interact unitarily with some larger system, and then ultimately perform a standard measurement in the von Neumann sense on this ancilla, on this extra system. If you trace through the steps of calculating the probabilities of these outcomes, pi sub b, you do some algebra, then it turns out that you can calculate the probability of the outcomes purely in terms of the quantum state that you ascribe to the system and some extra operators that are constructed out of these terms and out of the unitary interaction that you suppose between these. And these operators have the structure that they're positive, semi-definite, and some to the identity. So if you're uncomfortable with thinking of the idea of these generalized measurements, you can say, well, what it is just a hidden way of saying, I'm allowing my system to interact with something else first, and then I perform a standard measurement on the thing that it interacted with. Now, this can be useful. For instance, you can take a two-level system and interact it with a three-level system. There's some unitary interaction between the two. And then take the three-level system off to the side and perform a measurement, say, of the energy of it. Well, such a measurement gives you three possible outcomes because it's a three-level system. But you're thinking of it as a measurement on this two-level system. So you can perform measurements that have a number of outcomes that's larger than the number of levels in the system. And that's sometimes useful. I'll give you a perfect example of when it's useful. And in fact, it's going to be the solution of our problem. Suppose I consider some quantum system that lives on a d-dimensional Hilbert space, and it's given some quantum state, rho. Suppose I have one of these generalized measurements, some set of operators, with precisely d squared outcomes. So here are these rows. They live on a d-dimensional vector space. They're linear operators on a d-dimensional vector space. And I choose a measurement that has d squared outcomes. And I choose it in such a way that all of the terms, all of the operators in here, are linearly independent. Linearly independent in the space of Hermitian operators. Okay, so the space of Hermitian operators is a d squared dimensional vector space. And here I've got d squared linearly independent operators. Notice something cute about the probabilities that such a measurement would generate. Here they are. They're given by the Born rule. But just notice that this quantity, the product of one operator times another permission operator, has all the properties of an inner product. So you can check that yourself. What this means then is that this probability represents the projection of one vector in that large vector space onto another vector in that vector space. The probabilities correspond to just the projections of one onto another. Well, if you have a linearly independent set of vectors, and you have some other vector, and you know its projections onto each one of the linearly independent set, that uniquely specifies the vector. So if you have a measurement of this structure, then it's good enough for our Bureau of Standards. The probabilities, yeah.
I don't know what the end of it is. So the density matrix does not correspond to the state of a single system normally. It corresponds to a state of an ensemble. So what, in some sense, what you're saying here is that you can do a complete measurement of the state of an ensemble that would be an overcomplete measurement for the state of any individual member of the ensemble.
You're using lots of language that I never use. So I never said the word ensemble anywhere in previous discussion. Overcomplete I would use, and I haven't used it yet. So all I'm saying is if somebody gave you a list of probabilities and said, if you drop this system into this measurement device, you can expect the outcomes to occur. So I'm not using the word ensemble, I'm just saying you expect the outcomes to occur.
Right, because you're Bayesian.
Because I'm one of these Bayesian guys.
But
why don't we do it in terms of ensembles? Here, I'm going to give you 25 million copies of this system, and you throw them in, and the frequencies of outcomes will be roughly the probabilities I give you. Then the claim is, if the measurement device is of this structure, then I can just look at those numbers and recalculate a density operator.
But they're not all real, these d squared numbers that you the way I visualize what you say is that these operators are pick out the off-diagonal elements, and
yes,
the off-diagonal elements are not real.
They convey information about the off-diagonal elements, and the off-diagonal elements are generally not real.
Yeah.
But these numbers are always real. And the reason they're always real is that we have the requirement from these operators that they're positive semi-definite. So these operators are Hermitian with non-negative eigenvalues. And if you just look at the trace of a positive semi-definite operator times another positive semi-definite operator, those numbers are always real numbers. They're always numbers that are greater than or equal to zero. This condition up here ensures that if I sum up this number over the index B, it'll equal one.
But how do you get the phases inside the density matrix?
So I'll show you. I think I can show you that. So let me just, it'll be two to three transparencies down. So what does this give us? This gives us, if you believe it, this gives, in the end, it gives us a mapping from density operators, which live on a complex vector space, to vectors of real numbers. So it's purported that we have a mapping that takes us from density operators and plunks us into a piece of a real vector space, namely on something called the probability simplex. So that's a real vector space of dimension d squared, and where my points have a constraint, namely that they sum to one and they live in the positive quadrant. Let me give you an example of such a POVM, such a generalized measurement, before I go on to answer your question, just to show you that they do indeed exist. So remember back here, I said, choose one of these guys for which all of these are linearly independent, and I promised you it can be done. Well, here's an example of how to do it. It's a really ugly example, but it does the job. Start with some orthonormal basis, these guys, and form projection operators onto all of the elements. That gives you D projection operators. Now form the projections onto the positive superpositions of them. That gives you this other number of operators, D squared minus D divided by 2. Now take and form projection operators onto the sums with an I in it, with a different relative phase. If you take all of these, you can check that they're projection operators and they're all linearly independent. But the projection operators all being linearly independent doesn't constitute a measurement yet, not by our notion of measurement. We need more. We need that we have a number of operators that sum up to the identity. But we can fix that problem just by taking the set that we've just constructed, adding them all up to get some resultant operator, some positive semi-definite operator. Because all of these are linearly independent and span the space, it turns out, and I won't prove it to you, but it turns out that this operator G is invertible. It's positive semi-definite and invertible. So I can take this equation, multiply from the left by G to the minus 1/2, and from the right by G to the minus 1/2, and I end up with a set of positive semi-definite operators that sum to the identity. And because G was invertible to begin with, that preserves the linear independence of these operators. So there, one exists. There's something you can put in the Bureau of Standards in principle.
Question until later, but I have identified that'll make me before the talk is over. I can see that this is interesting mathematics, but I don't see what you gain physically. This is a question somewhat related to Lee's question. To use this, you'd have to have many copies of the system and make measurements over and over again. But instead of, say, making the same measurement over and over again, you could have made, of this new type, it's BODF, you could have just made traditional projection measurements over and over again if you use more than one of them. So
a very quick answer.
Would it be just as easy to have, you know?
A very quick answer, Raphael, is to say that ultimately what I'm shooting for here is to find an interesting sort of basis on the space of operators. And the requirement that I want to place on that basis is that it does correspond to some measurement. There are all kinds of bases that one can write on the space of operators that don't necessarily correspond to measurements. And so while you're at the dentist, hopefully I'll answer the question of why it's interesting to find those bases that correspond to measurement devices that can be built.
Okay, but if you were allowed yourself some measurement devices in the Bureau of Standards,
I could do that
too.
You
could equally well get this.
Yeah, one could do something like that. Yeah. The only thing that I lose is the thing that I want. I want to think of a quantum state as a single probability distribution and show that I can do it consistently. There are plenty of developments in quantum mechanics where you think of it as a collection of probability distributions. What I'm aiming for here is to show that there's a way of thinking of it as a single probability distribution.
Can I ask another question?
I'm never going to get to the geometric problem.
Oh, sorry. So I guess I'm trying.
Which is okay. You know, the audience just has to decide whether they want the basics or whether they want some geometric problem they can work on at home.
Anyway, that's my question.
Okay.
So I guess I'd like to hold on to the idea of the ancilla so I can sort of keep, following talk. I guess what I would like to know is once you've specified the physical system you're really trying to focus on, do you have to say something specific about the ancilla, or is that just a larger quantum system with the right number of levels? I mean, is it just a counting issue, or is there something specific about the ancilla?
No, if someone says, go in the laboratory and build a device that corresponds to a particular set of positive operators that satisfy the conditions down here, and you want to think of that process as involving a standard measurement, standard von Neumann measurement, which most quantum foundation people say is a mystery, and they say they don't really know how to do it. How does it come about? It's the whole measurement problem. But if for some reason you think that one's less mysterious and you want to construct this measurement device that I'm giving you in terms of that one,
then you have to reverse engineer these operators until they tell you something specific about the ancilla. They have to tell you about its dimension. They tell you about the initial quantum state of the ancilla and the unitary interaction between the two. And what you find is that in going from this level back up to that level, there's no unique, there's many ways to do it. One of them has one initial state for the ancilla and one unitary interaction. A different method would have a different initial state for the ancilla and a different unitary interaction.
I have a question for comments.
It ought to be a comment to me.
Well, with this earlier question about what if you have several measurement devices and you don't get the property you want, which is to have one set of probabilities, is really precisely equivalent, because you can always think of several measurement devices as some bigger measurement device that tosses a coin and picks one of them, since you're doing it a lot of times anyway. You might as well just call that a single measurement.
Yeah, you could.
You
could do that, but these
minimal. Be pretty, but it's in the framework.
But these minimal ones that I want, you can't think of them in that way. So you could take Raphael's device and think of it as one single measurement device.
But it will be a single set of probabilities.
So let me get to the geometric problem before I run out of time. Okay, so what I've given you to some extent is a method from going from density operators onto the probability simplex. What I haven't given you is, so I've given you an injection. I haven't given you a surjection, whatever those two terms mean. I've given you a one-to-one mapping. I haven't given you an onto mapping. It turns out that there are some points on the simplex, like where my finger is, that don't correspond to valid quantum states. So if I reverse the mapping, that won't map into a quantum state. So what happens is that the convex set of quantum states, if you think of it as a convex set living in a complex vector space, gets mapped into a convex set living on this simplex. The shape, this boundary, this set of extreme points, well, there's a distinction between extreme points and boundary, but in the way I've drawn it here, there's not. That shape will depend upon which measurement I have chosen for my Bureau of Standards. So in this picture, one can take the beautifully smooth space of density operators, which you can't really visualize. And I give you something that perhaps you can visualize a little more, but it's generally a very ugly shape. What I'd like to find is that mapping which makes this shape just as smooth and as pretty as it can be, so that there is a closer resemblance between the abstract way of saying what a density operator is and the more concrete way of saying what a density operator is. And now I answer your question, finally. So let's consider what would be a prettier measurement for the Bureau of Standards. So let's explore how to take these probabilities and get back to density operators. What we're really asking, or what we're really saying, is suppose that we have this set of operators, and it's an informationally complete measurement, ICP, like I was talking about before. What I hope I've demonstrated to you is that the probabilities for the outcomes of such a measurement uniquely determine the quantum state rho. But also, I can, because I have a linearly independent set, I can think of just writing rho as a superposition of these vectors, or these operators. So, well, what is the relation between these numbers p sub j, the probabilities of an outcome, and these numbers that occur in this expansion? Well, you just take the probabilities and now insert this tentative expansion into it, and just rewrite it in vector notation. We have a vector of probabilities is a linear transformation on a vector of these coefficients alpha k, where that vector is just given by the complete set of inner products between those guys. So you just invert this, and you get that the alphas that will appear in this expansion are related to the probabilities by some linear transformation m to the minus 1. Depending upon the structure of this matrix M, this will be a rather simple expression in terms of the P's, or it'll be a little more complicated expression in terms of the P's.
it would be nicest if one could choose this vector m so that it's diagonal. Then there'd be an extremely simple relation, one that can't be any simpler, between the p's and the alphas. Well, you can't make the matrix m to the minus 1 diagonal. And the reason for that is because you can't choose a set of these e's, measurement operators, so that they're all orthogonal to each other. But you can get pretty close to having something that's diagonal. You can get it diagonal to the off-diagonal terms are constant. You can make it so that the off-diagonal terms are constant, not zero. I'll come back a little bit more and tell you why you can't make the EJs orthogonal in a minute, but it's a fact that you can't. So here's an example of such a pretty set of things, just a simple construction that always works. Consider the vector space of Hermitian operators and focus on the trace-free operators within it. That defines a subspace of dimension one smaller. So that's a d squared minus one dimensional subspace. Now, once you're within the space of trace-free operators, consider the unit sphere that's around the zero operator. There is a unit sphere around the zero operator. Choose some points on that sphere so that you form a regular simplex. That will have the dimensionality of the space plus 1 points. So we get d squared points. And now just take and form these operators. Mix the points that were elements of a regular simplex with the identity. If you adjust this constant epsilon small enough, then the eigenvalues of this operator will always be non-negative. So this is a valid measurement operator. And by construction, it sums up to the identity because these bi's are points on a regular simplex around the zero operator. So that is one way of getting an informationally complete measurement. And in the end, you get a complete reconstruction of the density operator. All of the complex
indices at MJK.
So this
little A matrix?
This M is defined by this.
Oh, I know that. When you say it's prettiest when that is...
It's prettiest when it can be written as a constant plus another constant times the identity. Delta JK is product of delta.
Yeah, I know, but it's are there brackets around A plus B?
No.
The A's are form an off-diagonal matrix.
That's right.
Okay, all right. So it should be a JK.
This is the matrix entry. This is the JKth entry.
JKth entry looks like that.
The JKth entry looks like that. It's always the same constant.
That's what I think.
So that you can achieve, and this is a method for getting there. But now let's talk about the fun geometrical problem. Here's another one that was proposed that has roughly that same idea, but not constructed in the same way. This came about in a quantum foundations problem to do with this Bayesian point of view. This is something that Carl Cabes talked about first in 99. Suppose, that you have d squared one-dimensional projection operators that satisfy this nice symmetry condition. If you take the product of any two of them, it equals a constant. Well, from this alone, you can prove that these pi i's are linearly independent. It's just a variation of what I told you on the previous transparency. But there I had operators that were living very close to the identity. And here, we're supposing that we have operators that are very far from the identity. They're one-dimensional projection operators. So if you satisfy this condition, then you can show that these guys are linearly independent. And if you rescale by 1 over d, they sum to the identity. So if you have such a set, then you have a good measurement for the Bureau of Standards. It has the sort of symmetry that we want. And in fact, everything looks very clean. You can write the density operator in terms of these projection operators, where the terms here are of the form that we just talked about, it's a constant that depends on the dimension, times the probability of the outcome of making this measurement up here.
and then just subtract a term. So suppose that you have a set like that. These have been given a name. People are calling them symmetric informationally complete. They're symmetric, they're informationally complete. Moreover, they're rank one. They're rank one operators. Initially, we were calling this word sick. These are sick operators. But that ran into continual troubles whenever you talked about them in the plural, because then you talk about this sick and that sick, and the two of them make two sicks. And that confused people. So Steve Flamia and I got in the habit of calling them seeks, because it expressed the holy adventure that we were on in trying to find them. So from here out, I'm going to attempt to call them seeks rather than sicks, except in one transparency. Because if I call them sicks, then it would just completely destroy the joke. So you'll see. Where do we want to go from here? So these seeks, suppose they exist. I told you those things. Now, notice what I get out of this whole process, just to tie myself back to the initial picture where I had a Bureau of Standards and I had some other measurement device down here. And I said the ultimate goal is to be able to calculate the probabilities of the outcomes of this one in terms of the probabilities of the outcomes of that one. If I use this expansion that I just showed you, then just plugging things in, there's some new measurement, there's some quantum state. I plug in the expansion that I just showed you. What this shows is that I can calculate the new probabilities, Q of H's, in terms of the P of I's. And how do I do that? There's just a transformation matrix that goes from one probability distribution to another. Now, we quantum Bayesians think that that is an important conceptual change. What it expresses is the Born rule, just as always, but in very different terms. The usual way of stating the Born rule is to imagine that you've got this thing called the quantum state that's distinct from probabilities that you calculate from it. And you feed that into some kind of linear machine and out pops probabilities. But conceptually, there's this thing that's underneath the probabilities called the quantum state. From this point of view, there's only probabilities. There's my probabilities for this set of things occurring. And what quantum mechanics is about is how I adjust my probabilities to different situations. So the Born rule is now not considered a method of giving probabilities, but a method of transforming probabilities. Now, how do I know that this really is the best way to do it? I showed you a sense in which we had pretty measurements. But in what sense really is this the best way to enact this transformation rule? You might say, I hope you're saying, that, well, what you're really trying to do is make some analogy between our usual way of writing a pure quantum state as a superposition of some basis elements. And we're trying to do it for operators now. Well, it's always been useful to write our expansions in terms of an orthogonal set when we're talking about pure states. Why don't, indeed, we just play the same game when we're talking about density operators? Can we do that? Well, turns out you can't do that. If you want these operators A to be density operators themselves, so here, notice, if you want the I's to be quantum states themselves, which by construction they are, I can take an arbitrary quantum state and write it in terms of an orthogonal set of quantum states. But if I'm trying to play the same game with density operators, and I call density operators now quantum states, I can't write quantum states in terms of an orthogonal set of density operators. And one way to show that is the following. And I think this is a useful way to do it. Suppose you have a set of operators that are sufficient to span the space. So you've got d squared operators, and that they're positive semi-definite. And suppose that they're normalized. One can make a measure of, I'll call it orthonormality in the set, by taking the inner product between distinct pairs.
and summing up all of the inner products and possibly squaring it so it's not a trivial measure. If I can make these AIs orthogonal to each other, then in principle, there is a set of AIs that satisfy these constraints that make this number zero. But you can prove that there's a lower bound on it. Now, I won't show you the method of proof, but you can find a lower bound on it that is larger than zero. So following the steps of that, just studying this quantity, one learns that one cannot have an orthogonal set of positive semi-definite operators. And you get this lower bound.
You've got squares.
This follows from a couple of uses of the Schwarz inequality. And
no, just the squaring gives you positive numbers.
Yeah, that gives you positive numbers, but getting the precise value of the bound here, you have to do a little work. And at least the way I did it was a couple of uses of the Schwarz inequality and one other inequality, I forget which. But if you go through the steps that you've taken in getting this bound and you ask and you demand equality at each step, lo and behold, here's what you get. If you say, oh, you've got this lower bound, suppose you want to saturate the bound, then that turns out to be equivalent to demanding that the operators, AI, satisfy this inner product condition and all be rank one. So here's another way of saying what we've just shown. This measurement that Caves proposed in 99 turns out to be as close to an orthogonal set of measurement operators as can be made, if indeed they exist. Now, there are other reasons for wondering whether they exist. You can show some things about them. I'll just go through this very quickly. They have some other nice properties. If they exist, and everything is predicated on that, if they exist, then the set of these pure state psi I that go into the measurement operator form a set of states that can be used in some cryptographic protocols that are maximally sensitive to eavesdropping. So if you had used a different set of quantum states, you'd find that an eavesdropper didn't leave as strong of a trace when she has a look at the quantum states. You can show that they're optimal for some methods of quantum tomography. You can show that in prime dimensions, at least, oh, I left up the D, in prime D, there's a sense in which they look like minimum uncertainty states with respect to complete sets of Michelin bispaces. And if you don't know that term, don't worry about it. But so they make the expansion as pretty as possible. That's what we showed previously. They're as close to being orthogonal in the space of density operators as they can possibly be. They have some other properties that are of interest in quantum information. But the question keeps arising, do such sets of states with that kind of symmetry exist? And I should be wrapping it up very, very quickly, but let me tell you what is known. Well, we know they exist in dimension 2 because you can draw them. You can take the block sphere, and on the block sphere, pick 4 points that form a regular tetrahedron on the block sphere. Any regular tetrahedron on the block sphere, and that's an example of such a set. We know that they exist in dimension 3. By the way, the dimension 2 result goes back to 1973. And the dimension 3 result goes back to about 1973. But here, let me just show you some modern statements of it. Here, you can just play with vectors and just construct them. So here's one example where you use third roots of unity. Here's another example using third roots of unity. I write that these are inequivalent because if you ask, is there some unitary operation that will take all of these vectors to these vectors, there is not. So they're unitarily inequivalent sets. So they exist in dimension 2 and they exist in dimension 3. And there's been a lot of effort, a lot more papers than this, maybe double this number, trying to talk about the existence in general. As I say, the problem actually goes back in different language, in terms of the language of equiangular lines, back to 1973, where most of the focus was given to real vector spaces. And it was discovered that a maximal set doesn't generally exist for different dimensions. So when this was discovered around 73 or 74, most mathematicians lost interest in the question, and moved on, and they didn't bother with the complex case because, if anything, the complex case, I guess, was thought to be more difficult. But actually, the complex case looks to be more interesting. What is the great difficulty in proving existence? So let me just give you a hint of that. So what we're seeking are a set of projection operators, set of states, that satisfy this simple condition, that the inner product between any two of them is constant in magnitude and has some phase. Well, you can take the properties of these operators and derive a set of equations, a set of necessary conditions that these phases have to satisfy. And I've just walked through it. Just look inside the red. There's some rather complicated condition on the set of phases. I have to satisfy this, that if I sum up these triple sums of them, then I get some constant thing. And that turns out to be a sufficient condition as well. So I'm just seeking the solution for a set of simultaneous equations. Can't be that hard, can it? Well, but they're really nonlinear, as I hope the E indicates. And that's a bigger part of the problem. There are some other things known about these, but let me wrap up. I wanted to talk about the group symmetric cases, where most of the activity in this building is going on. There's a great simplifying hypothesis that one can give and try to put the problem of existence in those terms. And one ends up not with these big exponential equations, but instead a set of simultaneous quartic equations, which is still relatively nasty. But let me close now by going back to this issue of charting the shape of Hilbert space. So what's been done is we're looking at a set of operators that give a basis. They also happen to match probabilities. And it's hoped that when one looks at Hilbert space in those terms, one gets a better feeling for what it's representing, what the set of quantum states is representing. The greatest tool that we have in that project is something that I've started calling the remarkable theorem. It's due to one of the postdocs here, Steve Lamia, and Jones and Linden in the UK at about the same time, that gives a clean characterization of what it means to be a quantum state in the usual language. Suppose you have a Hermitian operator A. It turns out that A is a projection operator if and only if two very simple conditions on the traces apply, that the trace of A squared equals 1 and the trace of A cubed equals 1. It's remarkable, not in the sense that it's an extremely difficult theorem to prove. It's a trivial theorem to prove. I guess that's why Steve did it. Don't know. There's the proof. See how big it is? But it's remarkable in the sense that this theorem, shockingly, has not seemed to have been discovered in the many years of quantum mechanics. And I've gone to all of the guys that I know of in the field who would know such a theorem and asked them, do you know this? So the Elliot Leibs of the world and the Rob Calderbanks of the world and Daniel Gottesmans of the world and the Carlton Caves of the world haven't seemed to know this theorem. So it's a little gem. And it's especially useful for this project because one can take these two equations and immediately give a characterization of the probabilities that define pure states for these Bureau of Standards measurements. And one ends up with two equations, one of them very pretty. It says that the probabilities for the outcomes must lie on a sphere. That's one equation. The other equation says that there is a certain cubic form that must take a specified value. The cubic form is in terms of triple products of these projection operators. So let me just now close by saying I hope I've given you some sense of what we're seeking when we're seeking seeks. And I hope I've piqued your interest that it's an interesting mathematical question and worth pursuing, and possibly in a longer talk I could explain a little better why it might help us understand quantum mechanics a little more. Thank you.
expressions?
This is the one that's not pronounced C. John's going to be in trouble.
I'm a physicist trying to understand quantum mechanics. Why would I be upset if I discovered I had a set of information measurements that wasn't complete?
Well, why would you be upset? Well, most of the measurements we've always talked about performing. Like, for instance, spin in the x direction. So we have an electron, and we consider a Stern Gerlach device. And we let the electron go through the Stern Gerlach device, and it either goes up in the x direction or down in the x direction. That is not an informationally complete measurement in the sense that I've been talking about. Because if I look at, in Lee's way of talking about it, I send a zillion electrons that are all the same through the Stern Gerlach device, all prepared the same. And I look at the frequencies of ups versus down for an x measurement. That's not enough to reconstruct the quantum state. I can look at those numbers, and it doesn't tell me what the quantum state was. Similarly, for the y measurement, if I look at those numbers, it wouldn't tell me what the quantum state is, and z. But if I take x and y and z together, I can reconstruct the whole quantum state just from the frequencies. What's interesting about these informationally complete measurements is that there's one single measurement, one single extremal measurement for which I can just look at all of the frequencies and reconstruct the quantum state. So it gives me a mapping between quantum states and probabilities and vice versa. So it just gives me the conceptual tool for being able to think about quantum states as probability distributions. And that's all that's really interesting conceptually for me.
But you're still missing the collapse.
I haven't talked about collapse at all here. All I'm worried about really here is better understanding the geometry of the space of quantum states.
I understand the program very quickly because part of the motivation for this is pushing the quantum state into the back of the stage and bringing probabilities forward. One reason people believe they do believe the quantum state is because it's the solution of a very well-defined beautiful equation of motion. In other words, it's a dynamical object. You've been talking a great deal about kinematics, but if you really take this program and you replace, in some sense, the state by probability standards, how does this affect the formulation of the dynamics of the theory? Will it look as natural?
I don't know. It certainly draws out analogies to the classic stochastic evolution. So you can put dynamics in this language. That's another talk. And when you do, you see that there are certain analogies. So you say you have to give motion, deep evolution. But what is not brought out very vividly in the usual representation is that there's a way of thinking of that that's very close to just conditional dynamics and probability distributions. So if you write it this way, you see some similarities and you see some differences. Similarly here, and so you're right, this is all kinematics, there's no dynamics in this. Similarly here, there is some analogies to probability and some disanalogies. One analogy is that they both use the same things. One disanalogy is that in the quantum case, you only use a part of the same. So you have to ask, well, why is it I'm only using part of the simplex instead of full simplex? So that's what draws it. And that's why I gave the remarkable equation. It gives us an equation for the surface of that thing. Well, it gives you, I think, now the right terms to start thinking about what a quantum state is. That the structure of quantum state space is, at least in part, the theory of priors. You can't just use this part. So when you accept quantum mechanics, you, an agent who's immersed in the world and you're performing these experiments, you tell yourself, if I accept quantum mechanics, I shouldn't just accept any prior for the outcomes of this experiment. There's a structure that I shouldn't allow, or there's a region that I shouldn't allow myself to walk out. Because if I do that, I'm making a dumb mistake. And the world's gonna hold me to account. So from this language, you start to think, oh, what quantum states really represent is a theory of priors. And the Born rule represents not a rule for taking quantum states to probabilities, but instead the Born rule represents a transformation rule. So it just gives you different ways of thinking about all of this. And then similarly for dynamics, that part of the program is not working out as well yet. And one of these days, I hope to give you a better answer.
But if there was dynamics, wouldn't that go against the beginning of the talk, where you're taking this probability space and imposing physics on it?
I presume there is dynamics, and I'll prove it to you. I close my eyes, and I ask myself, is the world exactly the same now as when I closed them? No, I don't bet that it is. I bet it's going to be slightly different. For instance, you're going to be a little to the left, a little to the right of when I last saw you and opened my eyes, and you are me.
Sure, but it's not a possibility.
So there is indeed dynamics, but I just happen to talk about dynamics today. In other words, how do I update my probabilities when I close my eyes? That's what dynamics is about in this picture. How to update your probabilities when you're not gathering information. And presumably, the structure of quantum mechanics, well, it is telling us something about that, because I can write it in this language. It says there's certain rules that eventually boils down to unitarity.
Maybe one last question.
I just want some detail about that last theorem with the trace of A squared and trace of A.
Oh, remarkable theorem.
Yeah. Is this A, you said A is a projection operator.
No, I said A is hermitian operator. Oh, yes. So suppose A is hermitian.
Yeah. And
so that's given. Then it is a projection operator, one-dimensional projection operator, if and only if the trace of A squared is 1, and the trace of A cubed
but
is 1.
Is it the definition of a projection operator that A squared is equal to A?
That's right. That's rather trivial. That's fine.
So
I can give all different sorts of...
It doesn't have to be one-dimensional.
So here I can give a bunch of different characterizations of what I mean by a one-dimensional projection operator. One is that it's simply the outer product of a vector. It's a definition. I can show that that's equivalent to saying that rho is hermitian and rho squared equals rho. And there's a trace condition.
Yeah,
trace
but
rho
then
equals 1.
Trace of A to the end is equal to 1.
Yeah. But what's nice about this condition is you might say...
it's the other way it's hard.
It's
taking trace A squared equals trace A cubed equals 1 and showing that it implies more than a projection. It's hard.
Thank you.
But if you plug in a projection, the other way is true.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's hard. It's not hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is actually of interest here is that the conditions are in terms of traces.
Yeah.
This equation, rho squared equals rho, you can tell yourself that that represents d squared divided d squared minus d over two equations, distinct equations. Whereas this says, oh, I don't need so many equations. In fact, I just need two equations. But one of them is a pi orbit.